Good morning, Dr. Wish. How are you?
Good morning.
I just tried to call you back, but you know, you were obviously calling me at the same time, so I heard you, but I had music playing, and by the time I turned the music off and went to answer the phone, you had had to try again. Anyway, welcome to our Are You Crazy Health and Wellness.
But it's supposed to be manly, you know.
I suppose. I don't know. But anyway, so go ahead, Dr. McGill.
Well, Elizabeth, for our listeners who aren't exactly familiar with you, although it's hard to imagine there are any by now that aren't, why don't you paint a little portrait of yourself for us, where you were born, where you grew up, and how'd you end up there in Florida practicing?
Okay, that's good. That's a good story. Well, I was raised in two very different cities. Cleveland, Ohio area, and Charleston, South Carolina, actually more on the beach on a little island called Sullivan's Island, just off the coast of Charleston. And my heart is in Charleston, I have to say. My mother was a Southerner, my dad was from the Cleveland, you know, Northeast Ohio area. And so I grew up in both places, and finally my father, who was a physician, settled in the Cleveland area because he felt he could have a more lucrative practice. But he forgot to realize that he didn't have any bedside manner, so it didn't matter at all where he set up. So he thought it was location, and gee, it was him, you know?
Yeah.
So my mother and my brother and I, the younger brother, we missed our Southern roots and our Southern, wonderful Southern family. So every minute that there was even a mini vacation like Flag Day or President's Weekend, remember President's Day a long time ago used to be 2 days, one celebration for Washington and a separate date for Lincoln.
Right.
So my mother would just, you know, we'd get in the car at 4 o'clock in the morning and drive all the way to Charleston. We'd spend the weekend. I spent every vacation there, winter, spring, summer. So it really feels more like home. So
yeah.
That's where my heart is. I just love my Southern upbringing, and it didn't fit very well with the Midwest, but that's how it was. So that's my immediate background. And then my education is diverse because it reflects my two really strong interests. One is in helping people, and the other is the arts and humanities. So I double majored in college. I went ahead and got a master's in English, and then a master's in clinical social work, and then a doctorate in psychology. So I've done everything from teach college English to teaching graduate students in human resource development, and serving as the clinical director of a major clinic in the Boston area. Our specialty was sexual dysfunction, which is part of my advanced training. And that's where I met my husband. I married my boss.
Uh-oh. Workplace.
No scandals. We weren't married to anybody else. No scandals. We kept it above board. But we knew each other as strictly as colleagues for a whole year. And then we just, you know, like, you know, two little stars coming together, we just felt like, well, you know, let's just let everybody know so that we know, you know, whispering. But one of the most important things I did, and this is a great tip for, in general, for protecting yourself, I made my, I didn't know he was going to be my husband, but I kind of guessed we would be.
The women always know that. Somehow they figure it out. But
my husband knew before I did. He knew instantly.
Did he really?
Yeah, instantly.
Okay.
Yeah, instantly. And I took longer, but that's okay. And so we were walking on the beach, discussing our plans, and we had passed a bank with a notary sign in the window. Maybe I've told this story before, but it's one of my favorites. I said to my future husband to be, I said, if we're going to have an intimate relationship and if for some reason it heads south, I don't want to lose this incredible job. So you're going to go sign an affidavit, notarized, that says if it does head south, I won't lose my job. And that's what we did.
Ah-ha-ha.
Okay.
Well, that affidavit, okay. I don't know whether under the latest in labor law, whether that would save you, but
well, no, but it did psychologically and morally, ethically.
Right.
So that's more important.
Right.
And then my husband is a Bostonian. I came to Boston in part because I wanted to be living near my brother, who is also based there.
Mm-hmm.
And And then after our daughter grew up and went off to college, my husband had enough of Boston. He'd grown up in the area, mm-hmm. and he had gone to undergrad at Miami in Florida, and he said, "We're moving to Florida." And I said, "No, I want to go to Charleston." But South Carolina doesn't have all those wonderful tax-exempt laws and all those things that Florida does.
Oh, so financially it was a better deal in Florida.
Much better. So our deal was, I and we would go to Charleston as many times as I wanted, and that I got to pick where we lived in Florida. And the only place that really spoke to me was where I live now, which is Sarasota, Florida. And what sold me on it was the funky downtown, the opera house, because I grew up on opera, lots of theaters, including regional theaters and you know, equity theaters. And they had a great performing arts center, unbelievable beaches, and a very, very charitable community. And that's right. What did it.
Oh, wow. That's cool. I mean, that's good. And, so,
and Dr. Wish, how did you get into therapy? What attracted you to the helping field of therapy? Becoming a therapist.
I think I was born into it. I don't think I chose it. It my genetics chose me. I always liked helping people. My girlfriends were the ones who came to me with their love problems, and I was very intuitive from an early age, and I just really was drawn to it. And I knew that that would be something in some way I would want to do, but I also loved the arts, art history, and particularly film and literature. My mother would wake me up at 11:30 at night, 11:25 at night, and say, "You've got to come downstairs because, you know, there's a classic Betty Davis movie on TV." And then at 1 o'clock would be some classic Joan Crawford movie. And I mean, I just got the most amazing film education and appreciation. And she also bought me my very first book that I could read on my own, which was a Nancy Drew mystery. So I got hooked on reading all kinds of literature. So I straddled both worlds, and my education reflects that.
What was your interest or major interest when you got in English?
You mean in English?
Yeah, American, British, something?
My specialty was the novel, the development of the novel.
Oh, okay.
I have just a few addictions, true addictions in life. Like, if you took it away from me, I don't know what I'd do. One of them is Jane Austen. I can't read enough about her, by her. I have every British and English movie and documentary.
Right.
The other is traveling. I love to travel. I can't imagine, you know, not having that in my life. And those are my major ones that I can't imagine doing without them. And then I really like movies and helping people. So it kind of covers all those bases.
How are you on Moby Dick?
That's one of the few books that I could never finish. Could not finish it. Absolutely. I mean, I tried. I would read the ending and then the middle, then the beginning, and then start. I mean, I couldn't get through that.
Interesting.
You know, Dr. Wish, you remind me of a text that a friend of mine sent me just this morning, who's actually a Floridian. She's up in Pensacola, Florida. And
sure.
It's a quote from Mark Twain, Innocents Abroad, and it is, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry,
yeah.
and narrow-mindedness.
Absolutely.
And many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime."
I solely agree. I'm addicted to travel. I mean, we'll be traveling somewhere and I'll be planning the next trip, or on a cruise and planning the next one. And I love travel, and I've lived in another country. And when you live outside of your comfort zone, you either love it or hate it. And a lot of people in the program, it was an exchange program, just cried the whole time they were there. They couldn't wait to get home. And man, I just wanted to sign up for more. So it either opens your world or frightens you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of discussion online these days about racism and bigotry and xenophobia and so forth. And a common theme is that folks are taking people with very narrow-minded ideas to task for the reality that they just have never met someone who's of another race or another religion or from another country because of their isolation in some part of the country. And that if they had traveled, if they had ventured out, if they got to know people, they would see the differences, but they'd also come to learn the common ground, the commonness among people of different backgrounds.
Absolutely. And I know that I've mentioned this before on your show, but when I was in graduate school for my doctorate, I became friendly with a man who's in our classes from Durban, South Africa. And he said that after apartheid, what they did in many of the school systems, but especially in his town, was they paired white kids with black kids. And they made them be study pals in each class. He had a different study pal for each class. And a chance to work together and get to know each other. And that one-to-one really, really helped erode a lot of prejudice.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're living in some really divisive times in terms of relations between people of different religions and races. And you know, I had an acquaintance say to me a few weeks ago that she thought we just talk too much about race. And, you know, it was a group of us having brunch, and several just really took her to task and said, you know, I respectfully disagree with you profoundly. You know, we have to talk about these things. Not talking about them just breeds more misunderstanding and misinterpretations.
Absolutely. And in some of the diversity sections of classes that I taught to grad students, I always started the class by saying, I want you to think about a time when you felt misunderstood and improperly, incorrectly judged. And I want you to write a few notes down on a piece of paper, and we're going to go around the room, and we're going to talk about how painful that was and why it upset you and how it hurt you. And so that was my lead-in to get people to connect personally on how awful it is to be judged by your income status, your race, your religion, how you looked, where you lived, what you believed in, what you voted for. And that was a very, very powerful way to get people to connect to those feelings.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, Dr. Wish, you told me to surprise you with a topic for today.
Yes, so please.
One thing I thought about was how to find the best therapist for you, because recently a family member approached me about trying to find a therapist for their child who was experiencing depression and sort of failure to launch issues and so forth. So It brought it home for me how it is, it's a difficult task to necessarily find the right therapist for you. So I went online, and there actually is not a lot written about it. I found one article by a licensed marriage and family therapist from 2011, how to find the best therapist for you. And she starts with some very humorous examples from when she was a child, and she was sent to see a therapist for some reason, and the therapist used to eat cottage cheese with her mouth open during her sessions. She said, you know, she feels sure that her mouth full of curds gave her more nightmares. That's one of the reasons she was sent to Thursday. So she starts out with that, and then she goes into some certain suggestions, such as asking friends and family. Let's see. Number two was shop online. Number three was a picture tells a story, talking about looking at the therapist's photo online and just kind of seeing if it resonates with you, as opposed to someone who has sort of a fashion photo, glamour photo.
Right.
A category is gender, theoretical orientation. Let's see. Call them, actually have a conversation with them. And then the last item is notice. Notice how you feel on the phone with the therapist. So I thought, how does that grab you as a topic?
That's a great topic because I have often been asked to give someone a referral or how to find a therapist. So I'm going to give you a couple of websites for your listeners to go to. Okay? One is called helpstartshere.org.
All one word? Help starts.
All help. One word. Helpstartshere.org.
Okay. Yeah.
That is the help website for the National Association of Social Workers. And on their website, you'll see the tab, and one of them will be Find a Social Worker. And you scroll down, and a bunch of drop-down choices will open up, and you go to Help. If it's one that you select, the first one starts is Help Starts Here, okay? And under it is Help Pro Therapist Finder. There's also a Psychology Today therapy directory. So that's a very good website to start with, helpstartshere.org. The other one you can go to, and I'm just going to check it out to make sure I'm giving you the correct one. So I'm going on my computer right now, but I'm pretty sure it's the right one. This is the organization for the American Psychological Association. And let me just make sure that they have a tab that says Find a Therapist. The main website is APA.org. And let me see if I can find where to find a therapist, because it might be a separate tab. So I'm going to put in the search engine, Find a Therapist. And let's see if a separate link, okay? Because that's also a good place to go. Okay.
Okay.
So I did find a therapist, and I didn't see when you take it. Okay. I'm not seeing the one. So it looks like Help Starts Here includes Psychology Today. The other thing you can do is, this is what some of my clients did. They put in the search engine of Google or whatever you use, therapist, anxiety disorders, therapist, children, whatever you're looking for, and then your town. Mm-hmm. And that will help you also.
Okay.
The other thing you can do is call the American Psychological Association and call the National Association of Social Workers. And the third one you can call is the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapists, so that you're not wasting your time going, right, you know, through the internet and ask them, what is the tab I go to find a therapist? And yeah, usually I know for sure on the National Association of Social Workers that you can put in your town and what you're looking for, divorce counseling, marriage counseling, children, yeah, adolescents. And then what you want to do is you want to click on the profile. There'll be a person's picture. There'll be a list of what their specialties are. You want someone who does not say, I do a little bit of everything. You want to see your specialty.
Right.
You don't. When I was the clinical director of the Institute in Boston, I was in charge of hiring. And we would put an ad in the paper, and it would say specifically what we were looking for, you know, someone who did children or anxiety disorders, phobias, whatever. And I would get a bunch of resumes, and some of them would look pretty good, and I would interview those people. And one of the first questions I would ask them would be, what is your orientation theoretically? You know, how do you approach a person? And when they said eclectic, I knew that that was not going to work. Because I wanted,
That never works.
What does that mean? I reach into my shoebox or my kitchen sink, and yeah, I want someone who's a specialist.
I go with my gut.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's right. I mean, you wouldn't want to go to a person who specializes in heart disease if you ask the doctor, what's your specialty and what's your approach? Well, you know, I'm eclectic. I do a little of this, a little of that. No, you go, no, I don't think that would work out. So you have to pretend that you're not asking for something emotionally and psychologically, but something as though this were a medical aspect of your body. You know, if you broke your leg, you don't go to a gynecologist, okay? So think, look for a match, someone who says 15 years of advanced training in anxiety, you know, 14 years of training in marital and, you know, divorce. Look for that specialty, and you'll see their picture, and then you should be able to email, text, or call that person. A lot of times people would call the Institute and ask to speak to a therapist, and this is, you know, long before there was, you know, the richness of the Internet, and ask if they could speak to that person for free. And a lot of therapists would say, I'm not giving my time for free. You know, my time's precious. Yeah. But we made it a requirement of all the therapists who worked at the Institute. You are giving up to 10 minutes of free time to someone who calls and wants to know if you're the right therapist. So you don't want to go to someone who won't give you a little bit of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question about the theoretical orientation. Maybe both you and Dr. McGill, what does that really mean? Because will a layperson understand your answer if you said, oh, this guy is theoretically like this? I mean, is that a meaningful thing for...
Well, that's why you want to ask. Whatever the person answers, you know, I'm a Freudian, I'm a psychodynamic, I'm some word that you don't know.
Yeah.
That is your way to ask the person to explain it. And in my advanced training, you know, post-grad degree training, I was always taught, if you can't explain something in everyday terms, then you don't get it. So that's sort of like a trick question. What's your orient? What do you mean by that? So, and a good question to ask a potential therapist who you're going to hire. Remember, this is your money, your time, and your life. Don't get expedient because you've tried three people already and you didn't like any of them. Keep trying. So one of the things is to ask the therapist, what would it be like in your office? Do you ask me questions? Do you just talk? You know, I've never done this before. Or I had a bad experience, and let me explain to you what it was like. And anyone who's a good therapist and listening would ask something like, have you tried to address this problem before professionally? And the person says either yes or no. If they say yes, you'd want them to ask you, well, why didn't you go back? What happened? Because I, as your potential therapist, don't want to repeat the mistakes or missteps or experience that you had that didn't work for you. So that's a truly caring therapist as opposed to someone who says, well, I've got a 3 o'clock on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
LB, I thought maybe we could run through these categories specifically. When I think about when I have ever, I've been in therapy 3 major times. The first time with a Freudian psychoanalyst who I got to because of a referral from a supervisor. He was highly recommended from a supervisor. The second time was with a female psychologist who I was working with someone, and I said, you know, I feel like I need to go see somebody for a little while. And she recommended this other person. And then the third person was a licensed clinical social worker who did group work. Mm-hmm. And also referred by a friend who was a counselor, an addiction counselor, and had heard wonderful things about this man. So for me, it has always been word of mouth. But
you're in the community of professionals, so
true.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So what you know, she makes the point in the article that what if none of your friends or family are in therapy, or if they tell you that they don't like their therapist, then what would you do in terms of asking around about a therapist?
And also, some people don't want to admit that they were in or are in therapy. So, you know, there's a lot of downsides to that, you know.
Yeah, right.
So you could ask your family practitioner. You could ask your gynecologist or any physician who you are really close to and trust. And some of it is going to be trial and error. And that's truly when you have to trust the photo, whether they're going to give you 10 minutes of time, whether they have expertise in your field or just, you know, general practice. You know, you want someone who really specializes in what you're looking for, or what at least you think you're looking for, marriage problems, anxiety, teenagers, whatever that is. And sometimes it is trial and error. You know, you might just say, look, do you see people for half a session? I mean, I did that all the time, because particularly for new people, you know, they didn't want to commit to the full thing and use all their insurance or all their out-of-pocket. So you want a therapist who will work with you. And, you know, when a therapist says, all my clients love me, I never had misfires, you don't want that person either, you know?
Because that's not true, you mean.
It's not, can't be true. It can't be, you know? Right. It can't be true.
Yeah.
So those are the red flags. Think of it as trial and error, as the way you would pick friends and whether it works out and whether it feels right. And you know, it's your part of your homework, and it does take a little bit of time.
Well, for example, now here's, let me add a little wrinkle into this question. For example, in West Virginia, there aren't very many dentists. I'm just giving an example of a certain kind of thing. Because very few people have any insurance to pay any dental costs at all.
Right, okay? Right.
Whereas across the border in Maryland or Loudoun County, Virginia, okay, where much higher income areas, and in the case of Maryland in particular, I'm sure improved social services, which permit access to some poorer people, okay, you know, you have a much bigger range of dental choices. Now,
sure,
I'm sure the
sure.
same is true in terms of getting a hold of a competent, you know, of working through the choices you were just summarizing there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Might not be available in some areas, right? That's a
yes,
issue.
That's right. That's right. That's hard. Luckily, some of these dental clinics have opened up, and a lot of those are quite good.
Right.
And the other thing, what is so wonderful, is that you can Google people. You can go on Facebook. You can learn about them. I mean, you're not blind anymore,
mm-hmm.
which is just fantastic. You know, before, it was your doctor referred you, your friend who might have told you, or you went to where there was a sliding fee scale at, you know, Catholic Charities or Jewish Family Service or your local, you know, whatever, and they assigned you to who was available, or maybe they tried to match you with who is good in your field. But, boy, you can go online and look up a lot of people and see what they say about you and the picture of you. And I think that helps a lot now.
So, also, now, if you went to see a how often does it matter what the gender of the therapist or psychologist is, you know?
Usually it doesn't. The gender and what their degree is in doesn't matter, as long as they're licensed. Don't ever go see one don't see anyone who isn't licensed in your state.
Okay.
That would,
right.
that just keep that. And it's just a matter of, you know, you're never going to feel comfortable going to see someone to help you with a problem, but you want to look for someone who hears you and has a style that, you know, eases you into things but doesn't let you get away with, you know, you don't want to go to someone who isn't active. You just want to go there and talk and talk and talk, and then the therapist looks at his or her watch and says, time's up.
Time's up.
You know, time's up. I'm a very active therapist. I'm very structured. I have certain questions I want to ask. I want to make sure that when there's 20 minutes, 15 minutes left, I say to the person, you know, we have some time left in our time together, and I'm wondering, now that we've had a chance to be together and you get a feel for, you know, what it's like to talk with me, what is it that you really wanted to ask or tell me that you were holding back until you felt that you felt trusted? Because mm-hmm. that always happens.
Sure,
you have
sure.
to assume that people are not telling you everything.
Yeah, my
and you've got
can't.
To create
I mean,
an environment.
Yeah,
my,
you
my
don't
gen-
know everything.
Yeah, my general
That's
question
right.
is...
And sometimes they don't know.
Yeah, my question always is, what happened the day that you called me?
Right.
You know, what exactly happened that day? But you know what? I want to segue back to the gender issue, because Ms. Clintus, in her article, makes some good points here. She says, when choosing a therapist, almost all people have an instinctive idea on gender they would prefer to work with. For me, my default therapist choice is always male, which, in fact, comes out of my relationship with my parents. I don't think there is a right or wrong when it comes to choosing which gender you prefer to work with. However, I think it can be clinically valuable to notice which gender you absolutely wouldn't want to work with.
Oh, that's interesting.
I would make note of that and let my therapist know about my strong feelings of no way when considering a certain gender for a therapist.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I agree with that. And that's what I mean, when I said it doesn't matter whether a man or a woman could help you, you're automatically going to self-select. If you're looking at profiles of therapists and you don't want a woman or a man, you're not going to look at them. So it's whatever is leading you, whatever your comfort zone is leading you to. I mean, there are lots of women, for example, who will only see a female gynecologist. And then there are other women who don't care one way or the other. So you lead with your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. No, that makes sense. My major concern. Yeah, if someone reaches the point where they're, for example, I won't go into details, but I have a friend who has been seeing a therapist, same one. She's seen others in addition, but she's same one for since the mid 80s, okay? And she never, ever put it on her insurance, even though she was covered, because she was in an executive position at a hospital. And she was certain that if it came out that she was, seeing a psychoanalyst, I don't remember what the actual name of the consultant she saw was. But anyway, that she was sure that would prejudice her future career. Okay, so she never, ever wanted it publicly revealed, in a sense. So that becomes, how does that play sometimes into the, not just choosing, but staying with a therapist? And I want to add one little wrinkle to that. The therapist sees a patient coming in the door, and can they make an assessment pretty quick that, hey, they have money, they got a problem, they're going to be here a long time? How does that professionally, you got income. You see someone coming into the door, and regardless of whatever else you think, hey, here's income. How does that affect the counselor's view?
That would be a pretty sad thing to happen, but I'm sure it does happen. I mean, when you think of poor Woody Allen, who's been, his whole life has been in therapy, and I don't know what good it's done or whatever, but yeah. that should not be an issue.
But
that
there's a LB. There's a joke among psychoanalysts. This is the patients that have paid for their kids' college education.
Absolutely, and their second home.
I'm going to handle the first part about the not wanting to tell insurance, because that speaks to me. When I went into psychoanalysis, even though my supervisors were very supportive of it, they were enthusiastic. I was one of the only psychiatry residents that had expressed interest in getting treatment. But I did feel that there would potentially be a stigma attached to it, and did not use my insurance for that reason. And, apropos of the current debate over pre-existing conditions, I was also aware that, if I had a diagnosis submitted to my insurance company, then from then on, I had a pre-existing condition that I would have to declare whenever I applied for insurance in the future. So that is a very significant issue, and I'm sure it's chilling to a lot of people, and the reason why many people put off seeing a therapist because they can't afford it out of pocket, and it would have to be on their medical records from then on.
I agree, absolutely. I mean, that it is a major problem. And a lot of people not only in corporate America, but a lot of the military don't want to use their military one insurance because there's a paper trail that you've got PTSD or that you're a perpetrator of domestic violence. It's a major problem. It really is, and it's sad, but that's the nature of, you know, using third-party payments. And there are people who, you know, will negotiate with the therapist saying, I'm not wanting to use my third-party, you know, payment. I don't want any paper trail. I like you. I want to keep coming. Is there any way we can reduce the fee? And anybody who wouldn't do that, I mean, you know, these are all the things that are red flags when your therapist says, you know, this is the fee and this is what it's going to be. And there's a theory behind that we've got to make sure that you're paying for something. Otherwise, you're not working towards it. Well, now all that's true. But my goodness, you know, there's a balance there between care and your rules. It's terrible. It's terrible. It is a problem.
Absolutely. You know, I was fortunate enough that the psychoanalyst that I had chosen to work with actually did give me a drastically reduced fee. I mean, I was seeing him four times a week, and I didn't want to put it on my insurance, so I took out a loan. I actually took out a loan in order to pay for the therapy. And my reasoning at the time, you know, I'm all of 20-something years old, but my reasoning at the time was that the cost of psychoanalysis was only going to go up. So paying for a loan and paying interest, in the long run, I would benefit by taking out a loan for $10,000 back in the 1980s rather than wait another 5 years or so, 10 years, until I could actually afford to pay for it out of pocket.
And that's one option. Other options are, no matter whether you can afford it or not, go to a place that automatically has a sliding fee scale that their starting price isn't so high, like Catholic Charities or Jewish Family Services, and you don't have to be that religion to go there. It will be a lot less expensive. You can negotiate whatever their insurance rate is and not have it show up on your insurance. And that's a great way to try out therapists, because you know pretty soon whether someone gets you, whether you feel comfortable with someone. The other thing is, going back to therapy training, when I went for my post-grad training in marriage and family therapy, the whole year, first year, and then parts of the continuing years, was spent on understanding yourself. And a lot of therapists have not been in therapy, have not had sufficient or adequate therapy, or haven't resolved so many of their own problems. So that's something that you should be able to ask your therapist. Have you been in this kind of therapy? Are you practicing what you preach?
Absolutely. You know, she makes the point that when you have that phone conversation with the therapist before setting up an appointment, to ask the therapist, have they personally been in therapy? And she says that emphatically, that, you know, if they tell you no, then they're not the therapist to go to.
Absolutely. Everyone's got something to figure out. That doesn't mean that everyone has problems, but everybody's got something to figure out, you know. And the other thing is, you don't need a quote in my English lit program. You don't need to be Shakespeare in order to understand Shakespeare. So if your client says to you, "Well, have you ever had a teenager on drugs?" and they say no, don't assume that they don't understand your problem, because you can't have every problem in the universe in order to help someone. So people can understand your issue. What you're looking for is that it's one of their areas of expertise.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, because you're looking for some professional help that says, well, you know, you aren't the only one with this problem, and we know things about these questions, you know, so we have at least valuable information about it.
Definitely, and check in the Yellow Pages to see if they have an ad. I mean, when the Institute, we had a huge ad in the Yellow Pages, you know, individual therapists match with your difficulties, the ones that we treat, a list of them. And we were, the people who were going through the Yellow Pages could read that. They just weren't going to go to someone with general training. You know, everyone we had had an expertise area, and that's why we had like 14 therapists, because there were so many things that, you know, you can't do everything, and that's what you're looking for.
Exactly. You know, to your point about finding organizations or clinics to go to, she makes the point about training hospitals. You know, when I was in psychiatric training, you know, I several days a week went to an outfit in Washington called the Washington School of Psychiatry, mm-hmm. where people would come for individual or group therapy. And so I was an intern in training who would see the client, and for every hour that I saw the client, I had to see a supervisor and
Correct.
Review in detail exactly what the session was about. And
Right.
you know, you had to take what are called process notes, where immediately
Exactly.
after the session, I had to write down exactly what I recalled the back and forth was in order to present that to the supervisor. And their point that Ms. Cletus makes in the article is that you're in effect getting two therapists for the price of one, because you
Right.
have the intern and then you have the supervisor
Right.
reviewing, you know, what is being talked about.
Yes, and my training included being watched behind a one-way mirror and the phone ringing saying, come, you know, ask this question or try this or... very
right.
important, very important,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that was my family therapy training.
Yes, absolutely.
Behind a mirror
yep.
and,
mm-hmm.
You know, being called, you know, a tap on the window to come out and, right. you know, focus back on this or focus
yes,
back on
exactly.
that, or you're all
exactly.
trapped there and so forth. Yeah. And the fact, you know, people think the client, well, as a trainee, you're thinking, oh, this is horrible. You know, the client's probably thinking, I don't know what I'm doing or so forth. But actually, I felt that they felt honored and really paid attention to that you had that many people, you know, observing and
yes.
wanting to get it right with them.
Exactly. That left room for error.
For sure.
And
so,
again, the most research. Go ahead.
But no, I just want to ask you. I mean, have either of you? I mean, both of you have practiced for quite a few years in one form, various
decades,
forms.
Decades. Yes.
Decades. Okay. And have you made serious misjudgments about people that come to see you? In other words, you came in, they had an initial interview or something like that, and then you made probably an initial assessment of some kind, but later you found out you were completely mistaken. I mean, does that happen much often? Even after you've had some experience, I can see how an intern, that could be easy for that to happen, but is the unexpected a pretty frequent feature of professional counseling?
Well, I think LB spoke to that we expect the unexpected. You know, if I'm seeing someone individually, I really don't expect that I'm going to get the real untold story until at least, you know, a month or so into
uh-huh.
the therapy.
I
sometimes 3 months, sometimes 6 months, because there's so much inhibition and shame, you know,
right.
you know, involved with some of the issues people are dealing with, that they really have to feel a rapport with you before they're
right.
willing to unveil what's going on. LB, your thoughts?
Yes, you have to assume that many of the people who seek help, as much as they want help and as much as they want to stop the emotional pain, they're going to withhold important information. I had one client who withheld for a whole year that he was having an affair. And I sensed that something was wrong, why marital counseling wasn't working. And one day he made an appointment to come see me. He said, I'm getting divorced. He said, it's just not working. I tried to give it a try. I'm going with the woman who I've been having an affair with for a whole year.
Oops.
And I didn't know what it was. You know, I didn't know. I certainly that he was having an affair or a long-term relationship entered my mind for why nothing was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But this was his way of saying to himself and his future ex-wife, I tried. But he, you know, so you have to assume that someone coming to see you may not be telling you everything. Or as Dr. Zaki said a while back in this interview today, they don't know what they need to say. They don't know that something's getting in their way. So they're not consciously withholding, but they don't know themselves yet. They don't know what it is. So there's always room for some surprises. I can't say that it's happened very often, but it does happen. I had this one couple come see me for marriage counseling, and I really thought they were going to make it as a couple. I really did. And one day she comes in and says, I served him with divorce papers, and I was surprised. And I said, I'm surprised. What, tell me why I'm surprised. What didn't you say? She said, I wanted you to know that all along I just felt like I was going through the motions, that this was not the man for me. And I just, you know, didn't want to admit that to myself. So that happens a lot.
Well, for example, I've seen, you know, a couple of instances recently. One was, you know, sometimes like a person is, let's say they're having an affair, and in this case they were, okay, and they had had more than one, actually, and it was a secret, you know, from their spouse. And but the reason they were going to therapy about what was wrong with their marriage was that they were actually desperately hoping that the philandering would be the thing they did not have to give up. Okay. In other words, they would keep that part a secret, hoping there would be something else, you know, but, you know, clearly somehow, whether the wife knew about it or not, that some underlying messaging was taking place that was sourced in this basically philandering, you know, practice that the guy was involved in.
Yes, and that's very common. That's called straddling. That what happens is someone comes to see you, they want help in making their marriage better, but they have no intentions of giving up their lover. All they want that's not unusual. They just want to find a way to have peace at home, and it does happen. Just have to assume as a therapist that you're not hearing it all. And because people have a lot of trouble, just like Dr. Zaki said, owning up to things. If there's shame, there's fear of being judged, and most importantly, fear of the boat being rocked too much, that they're afraid of bumping up against the straddling lifestyle they've led, where on one hand they're gambling a lot, but they want to work on the marriage, and they don't want anyone to know they've got gambling addictions or where the money's going, and they keep telling their spouse bad investments. And so it's, you don't ever really know a person, okay? Just think about that for a minute. It's really hard to really know someone else. And even long-term marriages, I've seen couples come to see me, or one of the spouses say, I never knew my husband had, this was a true story, had a whole different lifestyle with men. I had no idea. There was no signs of it, no hints of it. He wasn't missing at night. He didn't go off on weekends. He didn't show up at home at 11:30 at night without telling me. So you have to assume that there are parts of a person that will forever be unknowable by another.
You know, LB, John asked that question, and I was straining my mind. I can come up with a lot of examples as a psychiatrist of making, you know, a wrong diagnosis, thinking someone was schizophrenic or having some kind of simple psychotic episode, and then finding out later that, no, this is bipolar disorder, or this was a profound depression with psychotic symptoms. But it just occurred to me that when I was an intern at the Washington School of Psychiatry, I had a young woman, a very beautiful young woman, who was newly out of college, and she came to me because she wanted to break up with her boyfriend. Make a long story short, this was the time when I would see a supervisor after each session. Well, after about seeing this young woman for probably 6-9 months or so, maybe a year, she suddenly said to me that she thought she was a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked a lot about this. I took it back to my supervisor. In that day and time, with Freudian psychoanalysts, you remember that homosexuality was still considered a perversion.
Correct.
And that it was abnormal. So thinking back on this, at one point during one of the sessions, she pointedly looked at me and said, do you think I'm a lesbian? And mm-hmm. I, rather than say, I don't know, or why do you want me to make that assessment?
Right.
I simply said, no, I don't. And yeah, it just occurred to me. I haven't thought about that in many, many years, but I feel badly. I regret to this day that I mm-hmm, didn't mm-hmm. handle that differently.
That's so interesting.
Well,
that's
you know, yet it's very honest of you, because that is something, I mean, I look back and I can think of situations that I would have handled differently. And when a therapist doesn't, you know, own up to that, then you don't want to go to that therapist either, okay? Because, I mean, we all learn, you know? I mean, when I think back on what I was like as a therapist in the beginning compared to what I matured into, I'd like to do some redos. And, you know, sometimes therapists don't know how they're helping. When I was first starting out with my very first post-degree job, I had a woman come to see me, and she was, I think, in her 40s, and all her kids were grown except one child who was a high-functioning Down syndrome child. And she would come see me every week, right on time, and talk about how her husband, you know, was, you know, not sexually affectionate, and how he called her, you know, dumb names, and accused her of being stupid, and week after week, and I never knew what the problem was. It was just basically she wanted to tell the story of her life and what was going on. And I would listen. I did very little speaking. I would say something like, oh, that's terrible, you know, to be spoken to that way. You know, that's terrible. I would acknowledge that was, you know, a bad thing to be called a stupid cow and all that. So now flash forward 9 months later. She comes to me and says, I've left my husband. I'm moving to another city with my Down syndrome child. I'm moving in with one of my relatives, and we're going to live there, and she's taking me in, and more than happy to, and she's got room in her place, and I want to thank you. You've helped me so much. And I said to myself, really? Isn't that amazing? And that's what the research on what therapy works has borne out, that the most important thing is not necessarily their style or where they come from. It's feeling heard, accepted, and feeling that you trust and feel comfortable seeing this person.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, I tell people that, you know, I had therapy with a black male therapist, with a female Latina therapist, right, and a white gay therapist. And I got something out of each of those therapies because I was really hurting at the time and I really wanted help. And they were really available, all three
right.
of them.
Right,
right, right.
That's cool.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the bottom line here is, in seeking a therapist, you've got to go with someone who makes you feel that they hear you, that you feel that you'd want to go back to see them, just like you would choose, you know, who your doctor is. I mean, I remember one of the first things my husband and I did when we moved here to Sarasota was try out different physicians to see who felt like a right, you know, family practice, you know, primary care physician. And it took a while. It really did. And I didn't know where they went to school. I could care less. I mean, I have family members who went to big hoo-ha schools, and they're the dumbest people in the family. So, you know, that's not the only determinant. So it took a while, and I didn't care how old they were, what gender they were, where they went to school. It just was a comfort zone, something that I felt heard and genuinely cared for. And ultimately, that's what you want to do.
You know, I see evidence in, you know, a lot of relationships or friends and over the years where, you know, marriages get wiped, or long-term relationships sometimes too. They get wiped out by disinterest. You know, in other words, I've seen people that, you know, the romance was great, but taking care of the babies, I can't do that, you know, kind
right,
of thing.
Right, right.
I've seen, right. And so, you know, loss of interest. But the other thing is meanness. You know, once you cross the border of meanness in a relationship, I mean, I think this is especially true of women, probably true of men too, I'm sure, but especially true of women. You know, no, I don't really want to be touched by someone that's mean to me. You know,
that
kind of thing, right? I mean, no, I just don't want that. That seems wrong. And I think that's the borderline that I know men cross more often, I think. But, you know, if you let your anger or your hurt, you know, just lash out without, and you can't take it back. Sometimes you can't take it back if it's mean enough. Frankly, you can't.
Right.
And
right.
It doesn't matter afterwards if you say, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't really mean it. It was just talk. You know, I mean, depends on, right? I mean, once someone says, no, this is a side of a person I did not know was there.
Exactly. You know, and you have to be so careful. You just have to.
You know, LB, do you remember this study where they put recording devices in the homes of hundreds of married couples?
Yes, I do.
And they said they could predict the ones that the marriages that were going to break up by the tone of contempt in the voices.
Correct.
That when contempt enters, it's over.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you want to? You can't reconnect to that, right? Without a loss of self-esteem.
The very well-known marriage therapist, John Gottman, writes a lot about that. He says he could witness how couples handle disagreements, and he could predict which ones either weren't going to make it or just have a perpetually unhappy marriage. And some of the signs are for people to pay attention to is when your partner does any or all the following: uses criticism, sarcasm, denigrating, and most especially in public. Very bad when your partner says something about you in public in front of other people, I wish she could keep a clean house, you know.
Right.
And then finally, walking away from disagreements.
Well, I've done that before. I know. I've done that before. But
yeah, walking away, Dr. Wish, I'm taking a task for that a bit. I think for those who can be explosive or, you know, you know, impulse control, you know, I've recommended, you know, say, I got to go for a walk.
I think Gottman meant by that was just shutting it down completely. I'm not talking about this. I'm sick of hearing about this. You know, no more, you know, shut your trap, you know. Archie Bunker, stifle, Edith,
right,
okay?
Right.
That's a form of walking away. Stifle, you know, when the door is closed and it can't be opened in any way.
Gotcha.
I don't want to hear it. You know, he's your son. We mean my son. He's your son, too. No, he's not my son. You know, I mean, you could almost repeat them. It's like they have unfortunate patterns, you know. And the other thing I'd like to say is that this is something that also I learned in my post-grad training. Almost all marriages or long-term relationships have some issue, important or medium important or something, that can't get resolved. And because you bring different things to the table, different needs, different takes on things, different priorities, and sometimes there just isn't an easy solution. And so the issue crops up in different forms. And that doesn't mean that your relationship is doomed. It seems to be part of the very thing that brings you together with someone is opposite styles, so that the two of you form a richer team with depth. That's what happens when people choose someone who's just like them and they don't have that depth. A good example, and again, anything I say is true about 85% of the time, because love, love is a wild card. You know, just sit in a mall and watch people and say to yourself, what an odd-looking couple. Right? So there's always a wild card aspect to it. But in general, you want your partner to bring opposite skills and styles so that the two of you form a really strong team. Mm. So that is what makes you strong. But in the Chinese proverb, that which makes you strong is also your weakness. So that what happens is, although you're very strong as a team, what you bring to it are your differences. And your differences may make you stronger as a team, but separately, they might bring something to the table that makes a decision on something, a standstill.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. I think that's true.
For example, I've had couples try to decide whether to have a third child. One was okay, two was okay, three is getting like, oh my God, what a handful. And what often happens is that one of the partners comes from a family of more than two kids, and they always felt that they needed a spare, another opportunity to have a sibling who'd be a friend. They felt closed off and at risk. And a lot of these decisions can't get quickly resolved. You just don't go out and get a baby, okay? There's monetary concerns, career, where you live, how big is your place, how much time do you have, are you dual career? You just don't say okay. And so a lot of these couples can't resolve that, because it's not like you can have an in-between child. You either have one or you don't. So it's very difficult, and that's a perfectly good example of how an issue can never really clearly get resolved. And you just have to assume that there's a drawer in your marriage or relationship that says things that are unresolved but will not kill us.
Right.
Wow. Okay.
You know, I was going to come back here as we're about out of time here, but I was going to, since we mentioned Moby Dick in the beginning, I was going to read a little section from a poem that Janet Harrison, our poetry show host, gave me yesterday, that refers to things to the richness of life that we don't always see, okay? And it goes like this. It's called Not the Idle. It's not the idle who move us, but the few, often confused with the idle, those who define their project in life in terms so ample, nothing they ever do is a digression. Each episode contributes its own rare gift. As a chapter in Moby Dick, come back to you here, on squid or hardtack is just as important to Ishmael as a fight with a whale. The few who refuse to live for the plot's sake, major or minor, but instead for texture and tone and hue. For them, weeding a garden all afternoon can't be construed as a detour from the road of life. The road narrows to a garden path that turns and circles to show that traveling goes only so far as a metaphor. Anyway, I that's a section of it, but it struck me when she was reading that the other day, is that the unknowable things in all the alternate people that you meet and all the alternate paths and choices that you didn't take but someone else did are as interesting in their diversity as the thing that's just like the choices that you made in life.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
So I thought that was a.
I agree.
A nice.
And there's
nice
nothing
point.
Unimportant. If you take pleasure in planting your garden, that's what you should do.
Absolutely. I mean,
very important, and it will give you meaning, purpose. Those are all the things we all want. And when I take a look at our friends, we have friends of all income, education levels, race, background, history, political orientation, sexual orientation, and it's wonderful. Richness should not be looked at in terms of being scary, because, you know, when you have everything the same and you make your world tinier and tinier and tinier, mm-hmm. I think in some ways you stunt your growth.
Good enough. Well, that's maybe a good place to start. You have a last comment?
No, I think that's good. I think that's
good. Okay. You've been listening to the Are You Crazy? Health and Wellness Tuesday on this day with Dr. Leslie Beth Wish, and this program has been broadcast on August the 8th, 2017. So that'll tag it for us as a podcast. And I now have a new practice, Dr. Wish. I get all podcasts up immediately after the show, so I never develop a backlog. There you go. So anyway.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for calling us. I love talking to you. It's been fun and informative. We'll do it again.
Always a great conversation.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Have a good week.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.